Hi, this is Andy, the host of Exploring Improv. Before we get started with this show, I want to talk about another podcast that I'm in called Rotary. Rotary is an improvised comedy podcast, and it is my passion project. It follows a series of characters through a rotation of phone calls, and it's just really, really fun. It's completely improvised, and I would love for anyone who likes this podcast to check it out. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, really anywhere you get your podcast. You can also find us at facebook.com/rotarypod. And without further ado, here is Exploring Improv. Welcome to Exploring Improv. I'm your host, Andy Barrett. Today's guest is Tez Yancey. Tez is a Los Angeles-based improviser, actor, singer, dancer, musician, writer, producer, and director with over 20 years of performing and teaching experience. He made his Broadway debut at age 14, headlined his own shows in Las Vegas, produced multiple recording and film score projects, and is a working film and television actor in Hollywood. He trained at the Boston Conservatory in Berkeley in musical theater and production, and has traveled the world teaching master classes and workshops. Whew, take a breath. Tez, how you doing today?
I am great. I'm doing really, really well. It's good to see you and hear you.
Yeah, absolutely. We were just talking before this. We're not sure if people are going to get to see us, but they're at least hearing us. We can at least guarantee that 50% of it.
That's right. Got that part covered. Got one of the senses covered.
Right. Yeah, exactly. As long as one is covered, one or the other, we'll just release the video only, and we'll have to read our lips.
Hey, actually, I feel like during this quarantine, things like that would be fun.
yeah, honestly.
What'd you do the past 6 hours? Try to figure out what the heck someone was saying, you know?
Yeah. So you have a ton of experience. So the first question I want to ask you is your story, how you got into improv, and not just improv, but the entertainment industry in general.
Sure. Yeah. I always say, whenever I'm asked about this in particular, you know, the arts chose me kind of thing. Like I was 8 years old, grew up in Boston, Massachusetts. That's my hometown. I'm living in California now, but I remember my sister and I, when we were kids, we, saw, it was Michael Jackson was the first performer I ever saw. Like I remember we were at my grandparents' house and her television was on, and this image came across the screen of this person making art with their bodies and their voice. And we were like, we looked at each other. My sister's 11 months younger than me. And we looked at each other and was like, what is that? Like we were drawn in right away. So that was kind of the beginning of, I just knew that I was drawn into that. You know, it was an energy that drew me in. And then I've always been like a curious sponge, you know what I mean? Like soaking things up and curious about everything. So I began asking, and, you know, my mom's like, oh yeah, he's been performing since he was a kid, you know? And so I began looking into all that and found out about Jackson 5. And then my sister and I, because of that, we got into music and all that and discovered he had done the movie version of The Wiz with Diana Ross, which opened up the door for us looking into musicals. And it was really a snowball effect. And my sister and I used to perform together. Her name is Tish. I'm Tez. So we called ourselves, brilliantly, as 7 and 8 year olds, TNT Dynamite.
So we hey, that's not bad.
We
that's
figured
bad.
That's pretty good, right? For 7 and 8 year old. And we called ourselves TNT Dynamite. And we would perform, like a lot of performers start really in their living room, you know, the living room of their home and my grandparents' home, and company would come over and we put together, you know, choreographed dance numbers and put together pieces. And we learned Everybody Rejoice and Ease On Down the Road from The Wiz. And then we discovered Annie, and I was, you know, singing Maybe Far Away while she was singing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow. And then the first musical we actually did together was the musical Oliver. So it really the long-winded version of answer to your question, you know, it started by seeing Michael Jackson on television, and I was hooked. It just chose me. So that was the beginning of it. Yeah.
That's really cool. So you were into, was like musical theater, you think like the first thing you started like seriously doing, or?
No, actually, musical theater was, I became a musical theater major in college, which I'll get to that. But it actually began with, because again, going back to seeing Michael Jackson first, you know, he was, as everyone knows, was a pop star and all that. So it was more, mm-hmm. and then I discovered the Motown through him and the Jackson 5. Right. So we're really, you know, we were, because musicals had music in it, we were attracted to it initially. But it really started right. with like the whole, you know, initially we thought, you know, you make your living as a singer or dancer doing it that way, like on the pop realm. So mm-hmm. we were coming from that perspective, like seeing ourselves as a duo, like the Jackson 5 were a quintet. And we saw it more on that realm.
Right.
As we, you know, started to explore more, as I mentioned, we began to discover more of the musicals and that whole thing. And ultimately, when I ultimately became a musical theater major in college, when it came time to figure out what I wanted to do, a good friend of mine was a dance major at the Boston Conservatory. And because I, you know, sang and danced and acted as well, all of those, and I was passionate about all those equally, she's like, oh, musical mm-hmm. theater. I didn't realize even then, really, high school, I didn't really realize that you can make a living doing that. You know, I thought you had to get a record deal if you were a singer, or join right. a dance company if you're a dancer, or, you know, do plays and television and film if you're an actor. I didn't realize that you could really get it all from a musical theater place in one show.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
So where does improv come into play? When do you start getting involved in improv, and when does that start becoming a thing you really are doing?
So my introduction to improv is very interesting because, you know, one of the things that I really am fortunate and blessed with is that once I showed an interest in this and it was brought to my attention at a young age that, yeah, you can actually do this as a career. Mm-hmm. I was so fortunate to have like my grandparents and my mom and stuff that was like, they understood the importance of training.
Yeah.
And that became everything right around the corner from my grandparents' house where I spent a lot of time growing up. There was a woman who lived on the street. Her name was Mrs. Bobbitt. Never forget her. And she had a little performing arts studio around the corner. Like she taught kids piano lessons and dance and voice. So, you know, my mom and my family, they knew Mrs. Bobbitt, you know, they knew her personally. So they thought, well, the kids are into the arts. You put us in Mrs. Bobbitt's classes. And so we started taking piano lessons there and voice lessons and so forth. And improv for me came through acting classes, you know, by being in class.
Right.
And that early on was, I again, fortunately had the right teachers for me, thank God, because they just understood it, the process. Mm-hmm. And so it was very common to be working on a piece, you know, from a play or whatever. And the teacher would say, okay, great, you got the gist of it, drop the script. You know, what's the through line? And improvise mm-hmm. it, forget the words, improvise it. So it wasn't necessarily improv comedy. In fact, it usually wasn't. It was very much just like, what's the through line here? What's the behavior? What are the emotional through lines and so forth? And so improv for me started there. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to, you know, this type of improv, you know, improv comedy that I now teach and so forth. And loved so much and fell in love with, that came out of that as well. Like when I, you know, was in New York and I started looking into, you know, improv classes for training, and same thing when I got to LA, it was really more so about, got to find a good voice teacher, got to find a good dance classes, got to find a good acting coach, got to find an improv, that I understood the importance mm-hmm. of that. It just so happened that when I, you know, I got to LA and I jumped into Second City, it was like, I fell in love with the performance part of it as well. Like a lot of people do, yeah. you don't know it. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't expecting that. I'm thinking I'm going to go in there and get my training on, and just fell in love.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I completely feel that. I never expected to fall in love with improv when I first started taking it, but I'm like, God, this is so fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you get bitten by the improv bug.
It's exactly what it is. Yeah. So how has, you know, a lot of people, when they get into improv, they don't have this really diverse acting, you know, musical theater performance background that you have. So I'm curious, how has all of that training informed your improv, your performance, and the way you teach it? Because I'm sure that it must have had a huge influence.
Definitely, yeah. It's interesting because, again, I mean, obviously, I pretty much remember all of the teachers and directors and people that really came at me. I mean, obviously people resonate, we're all different creatures, right? So different teachers sure. and different people will resonate with different people. So I completely get that. But mm-hmm. I was always really attracted to, like, it was very clear to me when someone was coming from a place of authenticity, you know, like,
yeah.
It's so easy to quote, you know, it's like I have all these great acting books and stuff. It's so easy. You can quote Stanislavski, or you can quote, you know, Meisner, you can quote, you know, Del Close or whatever, you know what I mean? And all those things are valid, you know, but there's something about the importance of understanding what you bring to the table.
Yeah,
and 100%. I say to people all the time, like I had a class right before this podcast, and I was just saying to them in class, I said, you know, we all come, I'm looking at the screen at a diverse group of people, not just visually and aesthetically and background, but in terms of improv training and improv approach. Mm-hmm. And that's good. And I said, and the beauty of this, and one of the things I think that attracts people to this, you know, this art form is that you can be on a screen in this case these days, or used to be on stage with people that look nothing like you from completely different backgrounds, and yet support each other and have this successful collaborative experience, you know? So I say to people all the time, and I was saying in class today, you know, you don't have to be a singer, dancer, actor, musician, writer. You don't have to be that to do this well. That's my journey. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can be the what was it? Someone in the class say business something. I'm not an accountant. Let's say you can be the accountant and still have a great scene because you bring your experience. How you play is informed by who you are. Like that's all we have. You know, you hear people say growing up, we've all probably heard it. Oh, just be yourself. Particularly, I'm speaking from my perspective of going into an audition, for example. Oh, just be yourself. And for a long time, that was really hard. It's like, sounds simple, but what does that mean? What does that really mean?
Right.
And you know what I mean? Someone had a joke about how, I think it was Chris Rock that had a joke about how when, you know, you first meet someone, if there's sort of a romantic potential there, you're not meeting them, you're meeting their representative. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you don't get to know who they really are until a little later on, if it lasts.
Right, yeah.
And I think that's kind of true. We kind of can put on these masks a little bit, and for various reasons, we're conditioned as we go through life and grow. That's just a thing that happens, society, family, whatever. Mm-hmm. So for me, I mean, I just think that ultimately how you play as an improviser is going to be informed by who you are, whether you want it to be or not.
Yeah.
To me, I'm interested in I make the deliberate choice to allow who I am to come in. It doesn't mean that every scene I play, I'm bringing in my experiences as a director, I'm bringing in my experiences as a writer. That doesn't mean, it just means that those things are a part of who I am. You know, there is somewhere in there is going to be affected by it. So,
I've talked about this on this podcast several times with several different people. I think that is possibly the most important. Let's say top three important lessons in improv is that you are enough, and it's like an onion. There's so many layers to that idea of you are enough. Because one, it makes you more natural. Like that's like one basic thing that it does. But it also, by bringing in your own real life experience, what we see on stage ends up being a reflection of your life. And that ends up being that is what like interesting theater is. And also that's what interesting comedy is your own point of view on the world. And if you bring that with you, even in ways that maybe you aren't intending to, but just using details from real life, acting the way you really would, you know, the note of playing to the top of your intelligence comes to mind. All of that mixes together, and it ends up being, more than just you're making things up. It ends up being there's a depth of truth to it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, there are these. When you've been doing this long enough, you begin to hear certain things. You know, you mentioned playing at the top of your intelligence. You know, discovery versus invention. Like these are things we hear that begin to sort of circle around. I was mentioning earlier about quotes, and I have sort of a, I don't want to say a love hate relationship because that's way too deep. But if I were to sum it up, I could it maybe it's somewhere in that category because again, it's sort of like, you know, I'm really fortunate. I've been in this business a long time, and I've got to do some wonderful things and meet some incredible people, and because of the nature of this business, the art, entertainment business, it's like there's this celebrity thing, right? And what I mean by that, obviously, is like, you know, what you know what I mean. It's like you certain people do certain things in certain genres. So if someone's known in the film world or the television world or the improv world or whatever, it's like some people can begin to look at what they say as absolute.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean.
And one of the things I say consistently in my classes, particularly when it's newer people coming in, because people that are there regularly, they already know where I'm flowing from, you know, mm-hmm. as I say, there are very few things I speak in absolutes about, but there are some things, like for me,
right.
boundaries, there's an absolute thing I have in that, you know.
That's immediately what it came to mind when you said that, yeah.
I'm like, that part, if you're in my class and you cross the line and are inappropriate for the sake of being inappropriate, mm-hmm. I'm going to say, thank you for coming, click and hit the button to send you out. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to rules, improv this, and you know, don't ask questions. You know this, and I believe me, I'm the first one to understand where all that comes from, and explain it as best I know it, and as I use it, and I always talk about it from that perspective as well. It's coming from my perspective. I encourage people to go out there and explore other stuff too, because pun intended with this exploring improv. You know, that's something that's important to me in terms of like the absolute thing. So in terms of the quotes and absolutes, I just find it interesting, you know, when people are sort of ready to, or easier to sway in the direction of someone that maybe they know. But I'm telling you, like, and I have learned some amazing lessons from people who just started improvising. Or just started.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I do know what you mean. Yeah, for sure.
And that's powerful. And I think that if I had known my own power, if you will, at the beginning of my journey, I think about that with everyone. So if we all sort of have these insecurities and, you know, so I try to, that's one of the places I try to flow from as a teacher in particular, and as a player. If I'm on a screen with you or on a scene with you, I want to come from that place. You know, as best I can.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm curious to kind of dig in a little bit deeper into the way you teach classes, and like how might you go about teaching a workshop, and what are the things you want to hit? What are the things that are important you to say in that workshop? What kind of notes are you giving? I'm just curious how your brain works as an improv teacher.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it a workshop, let's say like a one-off, like something like that is going to be a little different than like my ongoing classes, let's say.
Right.
For obvious reasons. I think people, you know, you have more time and you know. But some of the things that I've been, and part of it's going to depend upon who's there.
Right.
Because I'm for not sure. a one-stop shop. I don't want to be a one-stop shop person, let alone a one-stop shop teacher type thing of like, this is the only way I'm going to flow with this lesson plan. Because I tell people all the time, the beauty of improv is I will plan. I'm good at planning stuff out. I got my game plan, and then I immediately go be prepared to let any and all of it go in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, because at the end of the day, it's about, if I'm doing a workshop, I'm there to serve the people that are there, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm aware of what people need, and I've learned like one of my classes I call Nuts and Bolts, right? And I kind of came up with that name based off of, it was really focused on fundamentals, right?
Sure,
but also, I'm a big basketball fan, and people who know me would know that because I use basketball analogies a lot. there's a great documentary. It's a different one from The Last Dance, the Chicago Bulls documentary. It's a different one that I saw before that. But anyway, Phil Jackson, the coach Phil Jackson, who is known as the Zen Master and all that. I forget the documentary now, but he's mic'd up. And this is back in the Michael Jordan heydays, you know. And he's mic'd so you can hear him in the huddle. It's a timeout. It's a very tense moment, close game, playoffs, right? And Phil's talking to the team, you know, and he says to everyone, needs to just, you know, we got to get our heads together. We got to focus in. Everyone, you need to loosen up. And then he looks to Horace Grant, who's one of the players, and he points his finger at him. He says, except you, Horace, I need you to tighten up. And that right there, that moment right there for me was so profound, because he knew who he had and he knew what they individually needed. And that's the right. That's the thing, you know, that's so profound for me, because I'm like, mm-hmm. even in a workshop, like I can, first of all, we're all human beings, and so there's that connection already. But obviously, there's certain things in a workshop that you want to get across, depending on what the workshop is. If it's a nuts and right. bolts, for example, if I'm going to fundamentals thing, I'm going to make sure I hit the fundamentals. I mean, let's start with, you know, are you actually listening to the person? Let's start there. Right. You know what I mean? Obviously, everyone knows yes and, or certainly should, and that was one of the earlier things mm-hmm. I would make sure, and explaining what that is. Yes being the idea of agreement in terms of the world being established, and adding one piece of information we didn't know before, minimum, you know?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. those kinds of things. You know, fun, it's interesting when people say, well, hey, we got to make sure we have fun. Well, of course we want to have fun. I think that's everyone wants to. That said, I'm a big believer in this idea of, if we're here to work, it says it in the title, workshop. So if we're here to do yeah. some work, mm-hmm. then I ask people to be vulnerable and open enough to hear what's being offered. I'd like right. to think of it more in that way. Here's an offer, because you know how it is, Andy. You know, whatever path you choose on the scene, it's gonna be something. If we're looking at specifics and looking at really sort of learning what we're, patterns and things like that, then we can mm-hmm. pick it apart. Well, if this was said and that was said, then probably, you know, this might have been the path to look at. You know, things yeah. like that, you know. So the fundamentals, I'm a big fundamentals dude. I mentioned Michael Jordan, you know, LeBron James. People call there's debate over who's the GOAT, who's the greatest of all time. Uh-huh. But what I love about that is that they always talk about how fundamentally sound those guys are. And to me, that's no mistake.
Oh, for sure.
Best athletes can jump over you, can run past you, but they also have the correct hand in the passing lane. They're also doing the correct elbow, wrist, flick. For the free throw, for the jump shot, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, for sure. And to go back, I kind of had a thought as you were. Well, I think first of all, so much of what you were saying about teaching and the way you teach also completely applies to. That's also a great way to play in a scene. It's the same idea. You're listening to what's offered and moving along with it. And I had this thought that, especially the way you're saying it, it's almost like teaching a workshop. Is it's like coming in with a premise in improv. You have this premise, you lay down the premise, but at the same time, at any point, it may go in a different direction if you're listening to your scene partner, or in this case, your students.
Love that. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And talk about, I learn so much when I'm teaching. I know, again, that's something people say, but it's but it's true. It's like when you're really, I have to be vulnerable too. You know, so I teach from a vulnerable place, yet obviously I know I'm facilitating it. So there's a certain,
yeah,
you know, there's something like today in class, just as an example, that I'm open to hearing, because I'm trying to gauge, right, where people are, what we need, or mm-hmm. places we need to go based off of an example. Maybe we need to shift. Let's go into this area because we need to see this in real time. I can talk to you about it all day, just like you can read about it in a book all day.
Yeah.
But let's put it on its feet and see what we got.
Yeah, a lot of times what I will do is I will have a lesson plan planned out, and if we get like about 30 to 45 minutes in and I feel like there's other issues that need to be worked in, that's when I start like bending things around. And which happens a lot, because again, it's like, especially something where you're coming in and people, you don't know who's coming in exactly. It's not but even with regular teams that I coach, it's like there's still something may came up that I feel like has more either priority, or where I feel like more, this is where this group is today. And you always got to meet them where they are, not where you necessarily are trying to make them be, if that makes sense.
Absolutely makes sense. Absolutely. And I love that, because again, not everyone, you know, I've had those teachers that don't do that. You know, it's sort of yeah. like sticking to the game plan. This is what it is. And I get that, I suppose, if you're in a school that requires that you stay in a certain lane for this mm-hmm. level or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I understand that and completely appreciate that in terms of structure. I get that. But I just yeah. find it interesting, because particularly when we're talking about improv, it's improv. It says right, it in yeah. the name, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it is tricky, because it's like, I think you're right. If you're teaching a curriculum like level 1, 2, 3, 4, I think you do have to be a lot more strict with that, because you have to make sure that I did teach them this, so that at the end of it and when they graduate, they have got all that basic information. And I think that's a lot of the difference between just a straight up curriculum versus workshops and versus coaching. It's like coaching and workshops, and like I don't know really the word for it, but not like a school, but like if you like taught a 5-week course or if I taught a 5-week course, I'm going to be more flexible on that because I'm not guaranteeing that you learn X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
It's those subtle distinctions that I think are really important as like a teacher to realize, okay, what are these students here for this class for? And if they are signing up for like a program, well, then you need to, and you're guaranteeing you're teaching these things, okay, you're going to have to be more strict. But if they're signing up for get better at improv in such and such way, then I can adjust to that. Or if it's a team, then it's constantly adjusting.
Yeah.
And it's knowing where you're at as a teacher or a coach, I think.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. Like, you know, I as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, I remember different levels when I was going through Second City, for example. You know, I was very much aware of, you know, the level I was at in terms of like, we're at this level, so this is what it is. But mm-hmm. you know what's so powerful to me in that is like, this is why it's so important, I think, to understand who you are as a teacher or as a player or both.
Right.
The teachers I had there that were just, they had to stick, like I say, they had to stay in a certain lane, but their mm-hmm. approach to it, you know, like they wanted to, they sure. they were really wanting to make sure we were getting it. Their passion for us understanding it individually is, to me, that's the difference between a coach that's like, everyone loosen up, go out there and play, and Phil Jackson going, loosen up, except you. Or you,
right.
or you. That's the difference. And you have the ability to do that in 3.5 hours or whatever the class is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's being present with the people who are there. It's being present in the moment of like, because what you're saying about like Phil Jackson, he was present in that moment of what was happening to realize he can't just give a blanket thing because he would not even think of giving a blanket thing because he's aware of each individual thing that's going on.
Absolutely.
And you can feel that with a teacher, and that it's so important when you're performing improv to be in that mindset. So I think there's something to be said that if the teacher is there too, it primes the room for that kind of presence.
For sure. Yep. Well said.
Yeah. So we're recording this during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about how teaching over Zoom, like the challenges and advantages and how that's been different from teaching in the real world, I guess, on stages. How is that different, and how have you adapted to that?
Well, it's interesting. For me, early on in the pandemic, I had a certain group of people I was coaching before, like in the real world, right? So
yeah. mm-hmm.
when it came to Zoom, it wasn't so much of the learning curve was more the actual Zoom. You know, the technical part
yeah,
was a big thing, I think, for everyone, because we were all, you know, back in March and April going, wait, what? Breakout room? What the hell is that? You know what I mean? Like we were all trying to figure it out. So there was that learning curve that I knew most people were dealing with, except those incredibly technically savvy, which mm-hmm. I wasn't. I am more now and grateful for that. So in terms of the teaching and coaching at that time, because it was a circle of people I knew already in the real world, and
yeah.
we knew each other, there was already a rapport. There was already we came in knowing it was like a FaceTime in our minds, right. you know. So that wasn't mm-hmm. so bad. When I made the decision to eventually open it up more, because I eventually opened it up to other people, I just started because I wasn't initially, you know, promoting it on Facebook or Instagram or any of that mm-hmm. stuff, because it was just the people I knew. When I made that decision, by the time I made that decision, I had already been doing it for a little while with my regular people. So it wasn't so much of an adjustment. It just became, and I was so used to Zoom by that point that yeah. it was, and meeting people that way through jams, through, you know, improv jams, you know, and meeting people from all over the world, which has been such a blessing. One of the beautiful things that's come out of this unfortunate pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally why we're here talking.
Exactly right. We literally met during, that's right. Josh's thing. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So by the time I opened it up, I had, you know, I knew what I prepared what I wanted to lead with in terms of what I was teaching from. So it wasn't so bad. I just felt like I was meeting people like I would meet people in real life which is not different from, it's still me. I'm just on a screen and you don't know whether or not I have legs, but I don't know if you have legs. So, right, you know what I mean? So that's the only difference.
Yeah, that's the only difference. Yeah.
Although I do get up sometimes and get my groove on because I'll just be feeling something and they'll see my legs, but you know, so it wasn't so bad for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, you know, there's certain hiccups to it, but it's really, what really amazes me is that I think if this pandemic had happened even 5 years before, I don't think it would be as feasible to do this. Because thinking back, so before the pandemic, I live in Springfield, Missouri, kind of the middle of nowhere, but my team would get coaching from teachers in Chicago, LA, and we would have them Google call in or Skype in and be our coach. And even 5 years ago, it was like you would be doing this and the person would look like a Tetris screen and everything would be like jumping around.
Yeah.
And it was still kind of doable, but I couldn't imagine like improvising with that kind of technology. But apparently in the last couple of years, it's just the technology has gotten to the point where there's not major lag issues or like major technical issues. And it works way better than I ever would have imagined it is really the bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it, first of all, I don't think this is going anywhere, which is great.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, I think it's another tool to put in our tool belt, which is fantastic. But I definitely, you know, oh, sorry. I was thinking about your original question and I did have a thought about,
okay.
One of the things that was a little odd, this actually does not have to do with teaching. Well, maybe it does.
no, that's fine.
Seeing myself on the screen. Like,
yes.
Like that was kind of interesting, but again, that started more from doing scenes, like popping up, and because, you know, obviously in real life, you're looking at your scene partner or partners. So that was an interesting getting used to thing, and teaching. I'd be talking to the class and like looking at myself and I'm like, what the hell is going on? You know? So, that took a little getting used to, but whatever. Yeah. You know, you turn the camera off.
I actually, I don't think I've ever really talked about this, but I kind of have liked, at least when doing scenes, being able to see myself because it makes me more aware of my facial expressions and whether I'm conveying the right emotion. Because, I mean, that's even been a thing I've struggled with in improv a little bit, is I'm more of the writerly type when it comes to improv. But when I'm doing Zoom, I think I've gotten better at emoting and being clear with my emotions because I can actually see what my partner is seeing. Because sometimes we think we're conveying something, but then it's like, you know, I'm angry.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, we think that's angry and it's not. Like, if you're listening, I just made a blank face.
It was very neutral. Yeah. Hey, listen, yeah. I'll tell you what, if we were playing poker, I wouldn't have any idea with that face though.
Exactly. I should just play poker. That's really my
that's
technique.
Really what
I'm
this
ruining
comes
my poker face.
That's what it comes
yeah, I'm ruining my poker face. Yeah, that's
a great point, though. That's a great point. Oh, what, improv ruins your poker face?
Yeah, exactly.
Damn it! Before this pandemic, I was a great poker player.
Yeah, exactly. Then I learned how to act and emote, and it just screwed me over.
You know, it's interesting coming from the acting background. You know, like the acting training background. That's one of the things that I was trained in terms of, like, you know, early mm-hmm. on, like being told not to, look at yourself in the mirror. You know what I mean? Like if you're doing a monologue or going over lines or something, not to look at yourself. Like that was ingrained early on. So and it sort of stuck. So what I would do, when I would practice, you know, if I'm practicing lines or whatever, I would set my, you know, camera up to film myself and then look back at it, you know, cause I think there's certainly validity in that. Cause you're right. Cause depending on who you are, you know, people show emotions in different ways. You know, not everyone, it may not be seen. And if you're playing a subtle emotion, you know, something, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Which we do. Mm-hmm. We do that all the time. Like, you know, how does passive aggressive really look? Or whatever, you know what I mean? That said, I think that obviously in improv, that can become a game. You know what I mean? If you're like,
yeah,
I'm angry,
sure, yeah.
and it's that neutral face you made, then we get to make that a game. And now, you know, that's hilarious.
I think it's actually, not to derail you too much, but that's actually something I've been thinking about lately, is really, you can break any improv rule if that is the game. Like, if the game is that you don't emote, then, like, the note is you should generally have emotions and all that. But if that's the game, then that can be completely broken.
Completely.
Or even denial or, like, anything. It can be broken if that's what the scene is about and it's an artistic choice.
Absolutely. I mean, rules are meant to be broken, right? And mm-hmm. there's a bunch of experiments or exercises, I don't know what to call it, maybe both, that mm-hmm. I love doing in my classes and sometimes jams, mostly classes, that's the place to do it. I'm like, this is so cool because it proves that if you're committed to your scene partner, if you're connected, it mm-hmm. kind of doesn't matter. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Now, the justification game may be on because you're denying and questions. Mm-hmm. You're doing all the things. That's really fun to experiment with that because it just proves when you connect. I was on a team here in LA for a while that we sort of fell upon a form. And this was a group of like experienced improvisers, right? And we would rehearse, mm-hmm. Get together twice a week, I think it was. And yeah, twice a week. And I remember one rehearsal, people were human beings, right? This is what I love about being human and coming in and some days you're in a better mood than others or you're mm-hmm. stuck in traffic and those things affect you, right? Whatever was happening, maybe it was a full moon, whatever was happening that day, it was like three or four scenes in a row where we were in practice and we were like breaking all the rules, being strangers, the quote unquote rules, by the way, the strangers and asking a bunch of questions. And so but the scenes were really good scenes. When we would get done, mm-hmm. they were good scenes. And so we decided to put together like our own format and we would go out and perform. We called our format Strangers. And we would do all those things and deny and on stage, like deny people and watch the justification thing happen and figure it out and get there and stay connected and keep trusting and keep trusting and keep trusting. And then you end up with these fully fleshed out people and characters and emotions and feelings and points of view. And so I love that stuff. That's, that's mm-hmm. one of the cool things about this,
Totally. So do you know who Bill Arnett is?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So he is like the king of that. And I've done lots of stuff with him.
Yeah.
And like he will literally he'll just do experiments where it's like, okay, we're gonna break these rules today and we're gonna see what happens. I don't know what's gonna happen, mm-hmm. but these are the rules we're gonna break today and we're gonna see what happens.
Yeah, I love Bill.
And I love
Bill out of Chicago. Chicago Improv Studio.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's great. I met him, spent a lot of time with him during this pandemic too, doing stuff and so great.
Oh really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so great. But I love that to his point. I mean, that's exactly right. Like, let's see what happens, experimenting and exploring it. And because again, it's like if you're dialed into, you still have to listen. You still have to be connected to the scene partner. And those are kind of the two of the big ones. So if you're doing that, I always tell people all the time, early on I learned, to yes or no, So it's great.
I think a lot of this is something I've thought about a lot recently is it's not really rules and it's not even just, it is tools, but what it is that different things have different, it all depends on the type of improv you want to do. It's like doing certain rules, like not asking questions results in certain types of scenes. So it's really not a matter of arbitrarily do this thing and don't arbitrarily do this other thing. It's what do you want? What do you want your scenes to look like at the end of the day? What do you want your show to look like at the end of the day? And the choices you make in the scenes, it's not right or wrong. It's just, is it fulfilling that goal that you want? Or do you even have one? And being aware if you don't have one. Does that make sense?
Completely. Yeah. No, I agree. It's like I was talking earlier about the idea of these paths, It's like that going down a road and then you come to a fork.
Right.
And you get to that mm-hmm. fork and it's obviously this way or that way, And they both lead to very different things. Even if it's like a slight, there's a movie from like the 90s thing called, and I didn't even see it until like 6 years ago or something, but mm-hmm. I bring it up all the time. Sliding Doors. You know that movie Sliding Doors by chance?
I don't think I've heard of it.
Oh, you should check it out. I think Gwyneth Paltrow and someone. So, And it's also same premise for the Broadway show, If Then, maybe I'm messing with the title. It's this idea of like, and Sliding Doors is so cool. I don't want to give it away if you want to see it, but I'll just say this. It has to do with the slightest minute adjustment in a decision that affects literally your and everyone else's life. I mean, it's incredible because again, it's like if, you know, if you go right instead of left, then you don't meet the person you met when you went left that you maybe marry or you know what I mean? You meet someone else that you met. And that's the way I look at these decisions. And, you know, with this improv journey, you know, the more you do it and reps are so important and there's a reason for that. Now, that said, I'm a believer in quality reps, right? So like, so like you can go in there all day long and just, you know, if you're lifting weights and just do this kind of movement back. I did 20, I'm done. Versus like really focusing on, I call it the positive and the negative, the up and the down, like really putting attention on it, right? I tell people in my classes all the time, one of the things I started doing on my own, I mentioned when I was a kid being a curious sponge, that still applies. I've always been that way. Mm-hmm. Whenever I was in classes, whatever class, like an improv class, if I'm here or whatever, I'm watching the scene. I'm not in it. I'm going to be going up at some point, right? But I'm watching it like I'm in it.
Right. Yeah.
So when I'm in a show or a jam, even on Zoom, my camera's off. I'm like, unless I have to use the restroom or something, I'm right there. I'm listening, you know, and I'm on some levels, particularly early on, something's offered or I see something, I'm yes-anding it the way I would in my head. And then I hear what the other offers. I go, okay, we're going down that path. I wouldn't have thought of that because I'm not that person necessarily. And then, you know what I mean? So
I'm totally on board.
That quality reps, man.
Yeah. I'm really kind of like thinking about like that whole path thing. And I've totally thought that way before, but like, I'm thinking now it's like, it's almost the difference between improv that feels like it's has a direction versus improv that feels aimless is knowing that the choices you're making are going down certain paths. And a lot of times, like young improvisers, and this, you know, this is not a critique at all, but like I think a lot of early issues in improv kind of come down to they don't realize the path that they're on because they've made these choices, but they don't realize that those choices have implications that bring us down certain roads. And like, that's what game is. It's making certain choices that put us on a certain path. And early improvisers, a lot of time won't realize they'll get on a path or in more traditional terms, they'll find a game and then they'll hit it and then they'll stray away from it and then they'll forget that it was ever there. Yeah. Well, that's being on a path but not realizing they're on the path and the choices that make sense on that path. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that's precisely why, going back to, again, the beginning when I talked about understanding and it being instilled in me, the importance of training, you know, early on, that's the work part of what I believe is necessary in the classes that I teach. That's the work part of it. Like, you know, understanding you don't know until you know. You don't know until you know.
Right.
And the beauty is, you know, I can clearly remember a time in my improv journey early on where I didn't know what the heck game was. And you know, that moment where you're in a class and someone's like, you know, oh, the game in the scene. And three or four people go, yeah, the game. You know, game. Oh, the game is cool. And you have all these voices talking about the game. And there's that moment where you kind of go, do I jump in and go, yeah, the game. So I look like I know what I'm talking about. Or you know what I mean? Or am I honest and go, what the hell is a game? You know what I mean?
Right.
And obviously, if you don't know and you pretend you know and you get into a scene and the game comes up and you don't follow it, it's going to become apparent that you don't know the game, right, or you're not aware of it or whatever, right? So that's such a good point. That's why we do this. That's the work part of it. I always say, like, you know, do the work so that you can play effortlessly or as effortlessly as possible, because there does require some, you're still working when you're playing, right? But you know what it's like when you get into a scene. We are all seeking, I don't care what anybody says, I think this is an absolute, and I feel pretty good about saying this. I think we're all seeking that space of effortless flow.
Yes, absolutely. That's even what I was just thinking. It is that concept. I always forget the person's name because he has a million letters in his name, but he came up with the scientific concept of flow. And what flow is that something that is challenging enough for it to be challenging, but not so challenging that it creates anxiety, and not so easy that it's just like whatever. It's this place. That's what the zone is. The zone of flow is where we're challenged just enough that we have to give effort, but it's not so much effort that it is overwhelming. And then that's when we just start flowing. And if it's easy and it's super easy and we don't have to think about it, well, then you're kind of not really in the zone anymore because there's no challenge there.
I always say there's a reason. By the way, is it Nietzsche? Is that who that was? Maybe? No.
No, it starts with an M and it's like a bunch of consonants that are just thrown together.
Oh, you're
it's
talking like, about moon, rapid, 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 rapid.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
that's what it is. Okay, cool. I love Moon Man books.
Same.
Ah, <Yeah. laughs> bits.
Yeah. I'll actually look it up real quick. I'm going to look it up.
Yeah,
now
thank
I'm
you.
Curious.
I'm actually curious too. So thank you for looking it up. I support that.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the heck I was going to say because I laughed at my own joke.
Yeah. Okay. It's he was a psychologist. I still don't know how to pronounce it, but I'm gonna butcher it and do my best. I think he was Russian. Mihaly, Mihaly, and then it looks like Czik Zint Mihalyev.
Wow.
Czik Zint Mihalyev.
Wow. Yeah, that's what I said. Yeah. That's what I said.
That is what you said. That is exactly what you said.
Nailed it.
You nailed it. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I've actually not heard. I don't know who that is. No idea. So learn something new. I appreciate that.
Yeah. He's the one who coined the term flow and flow state. That's where all of that comes from him.
In
the popular culture, that all comes from him.
Yeah. I didn't know who that is. I know what I was going to say. I was talking about growing pains. I was going to say growing pains.
Yeah, okay.
There's
cool,
a reason why that, you know, that term exists, right? Growing pains. And, you know, when you look at it from, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it really came from the actual growing pains, like your bones having to, the pain of, you know, getting taller and all that stuff. So to me, I like to look at those things as that's obviously a natural state. That's a natural flow and state of living and survival in life. So, you know, I find that applicable to when it came to my training. I understood, like, you know, if I was in a ballet class or a jazz or dance class, you know, there's some, you know, it hurts to stretch like that, or it hurts to, you know, what have you. So there's a certain amount of work that is involved, and you push through in a safe way, obviously, push through the pain, in order to get to a place that you've not been. You know what I mean? And
totally.
That's something that, like, is really, you know, simplicity is a word that comes to mind, and I say a lot too when I'm teaching. I say a lot, and I say to myself a lot when I'm playing. Mm-hmm. Simple. Keep it simple. Keep it simple.
Right.
Keep it simple.
Totally.
Right. And you know how it is. I always, you know, say you can initiate a scene as, oh boy, your pot roast tastes delicious tonight, honey. You know what I mean? Like, great. In my mind is pot roast couple. I said, honey, probably a couple. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the next line is, yeah, I wasn't sure how it was going to work in the zero gravity since we're on Mars riding this unicycle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you're like, okay. And I go, all right, great. So obviously that's been offered.
Right. Yeah.
How do you ground Mars on a unicycle? Zero gravity pot roast.
Right. Exactly. And it's like, that happens a lot. But also there's less extreme versions of that that are still the same issue. Like, people will try to create problems that don't need to be problems. And, like, again, going back to what we said, I do want to, like, be clear. You can break this rule. You can totally do whatever you want to, as long as you know what you're doing and you know that's the path you're choosing. But a lot of times I see people create problems out of a sense of panic that they feel like they don't have enough.
Yeah.
When all you really need, when we're talking about organic improv, is just, we need to understand what's going on. And then from there, here's how I basically look at it. Organic improv. Let's create a situation that we understand what's going on, and then let's look at what the behavior of the people is. And then from there, that's where game will arise. That's where anything interesting in the scene is going to be the characters, their personalities, their points of view, their behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
But to get to that point, you just have to see them act normally. You just have to see them in their day, like doing stuff. But what I see too often is that people will force a problem. Like it'll be like, whatever your first line was, like, honey, I made pot roast. Was that
it? Pot roast tastes delicious. Yeah.
Pot roast tastes delicious. And like someone will be like, it's like, yeah, well, I'm glad that it tastes delicious this night because I know you've been really critical of it. And like, that's okay. There's not, it's not even that that's a wrong choice. And that's totally, if you want to choose that path, choose it. But choose it out of a place of power, not because you feel like you had to do that. Realize that you can totally just say like, yeah, I'm really glad you liked it. And how was work today? Like you can just sit in that moment rather than forcing an issue.
You know, what's interesting, Andy, when as I hear you say that, I love that. I hear you loud and clear on that, you know. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about like, you know, coming from this, as I mentioned, from the acting and music world too, by the way, like acting music world, because, you know, and this is why, again, when you asked me earlier about how my background essentially informs how I play, I think about this stuff a lot. I really want this for other people. Like when I'm teaching them, I'm trying to help them discover their approach. Right.
Right. Totally. Yeah.
Cause like, I'm telling you, when I was at Boston Conservatory in Berkeley, I studied music production at Berkeley. So I was around a wide variety of people. So music with theater people, which look, musical theater, I can say this because I am one. Musical theater people are some of the most on people in the world. O-N, yeah. On. Mm-hmm. And I remember, fortunately, a teacher early on said to me, find your off switch. Find your own off switch and learn when to turn it off. Everything isn't about a performance. And, you know, we live in a social media world, right, where it's all about likes and follows, right?
Yeah.
So that's driven by that same kind of thing. So being on and constantly coming from that perspective. So I say that because coming from that background with that and music, and it's not, there's a certain amount of undoing when it came to me doing this type of improv that I had to actually do. Because here's, and at the same time, it's also helped me. So allow me to explain. So,
sure, yeah.
When you talk about like people infusing problems, like to your example of the food, oh, you messed it up. And, you know, right. as an actor, for example, I've been trained and ingrained in me over years and years of training. And I still do it now. If I'm doing a play or a film or, you know, TV thing or whatever, scripted work is what I'm getting to.
Sure.
You know, you're looking at it, and for me, I'm a detective, right? As an actor or an improviser, I'm a detective. I'm looking for behavior, I'm looking for things. So you're taught early on, you know, what's your character's objective? You know, what do they want? And what's the obstacle?
Right.
And that, to me, I think for people coming into improv, because whether you're an actor or not, improv is acting. It's imagination, it's make-believe. It is acting, whether you approach it from that perspective or not. There could be this underlying either subconscious thing for people maybe not directly into it, or conscious thing for those of us that maybe are, that goes, I got to find a problem, particularly early on in your improv journey. So that's actually allowed me to be more empathetic when
people go
that route. And I tend to find ways to either, yep, I did it, I screwed up, let's end this fight, or, you know what I mean, or calling it out or what have you. So that's just sort of a discovery that I've made over the last couple of years, I think, of recognizing that, of going, that could be where that comes from. Also, things manifest in so many different ways. Nerves and adrenaline manifests in so many different ways. You know what I'm talking about. People, it'll manifest by over talking, you know, throwing out problems, not listening, many different ways. And I think it's important as a player, I want to be the type of player, and I aspire to consistently be the type of player that, you know, really takes that quote that we've all heard, you know, make a scene part look better, to the nth degree, to what it really initially came from and meant, which is be supportive. To, you know, regardless of what they're giving you, how do you make that work? So it doesn't look like, oh my God, they're asking so many questions to the audience because you're frustrated, as versus like, answering it, whatever, you know what I mean? So that's just sort of a thought I had while you were saying that.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you have to support your partner, unless of course it's like in a boundary breaking like situation,
right?
Of course, as we talked about before. But it's that aside, you know, if they do stuff like you think, oh, they're asking so many questions, it'd be easier if they didn't ask so many questions. It's like, I think the sign of a good improviser is getting to the point where you're not even thinking that thought. You're just thinking, how can I support what's in front of me right now? And if you have that mentality of like, I am going to support whatever is happening right now, and if everyone has that mentality, a team can be great, even if maybe they don't have all the best technical skills, but they still want to support what's in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
With that attitude, I think you can do anything.
Mm-hmm. Completely. Yeah.
So we're getting kind of close to the end here, but I had a few more.
There's a
questions.
Light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
Turn around. Take the other path.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There. Yeah. Take it back to path. Yeah. What keeps you doing improv? What is it about improv? Why do you still do it? Why do you teach it? Like, what is it about improv that you love?
Oh, we're going to have to have another hour.
A big question.
Another hour on that one, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll try to sum it up. No, so I'm going to start with self-care.
Okay.
I'm going to start with that because that's, for me, just the truth, you know, particularly during this pandemic, particularly. Yeah. You know, and I say that because, again, prior to the pandemic, it was a necessary thing in my life. I've been so fortunate to do some great things in my career. And prior to the pandemic, I was doing I had a couple shows. I was on the road for a while. So I was like in Denver, Colorado, and I was in Florida and doing like, I tracked the musical I had done and did this other show that was like, it's interesting. It was like a full circle because it was like a Motown type show.
Nice.
And then, I had a part in this, a film project, which is, I actually did some pickups for recently. Post-COVID, now they were able to do it. So I was I was moving around in different places. But I say all that to say, whenever I would get there, when I got to Denver, when I got to Florida, when I got to New York, whenever I was moving around doing these projects, it became second nature for me to look at what are my days off and is there improv nearby that I can find?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really, you know, I don't play golf. I know some people golf to relax. Not that, I mean, improv is relaxing even though it's work, but it's the same kind of thing for me. I understand there's a sense of peace, a sense of, you know, you need it for your peace of mind. And that's really what it's become for me. And I always say, I joke with people, but it's not a joke. I'm like, we're just big ass kids, man. You know what I mean? We're all really just big ass kids. Can I say ass on this podcast? I didn't even ask.
Yeah, you can say ass all you want.
Okay, cool. Technically, that's not a swear, but anyway. That's as far as I'll go. But yeah, you know, and tapping into that imagination, I think is so vital and important. And so it's always been a self-care thing for me in that sense. And certainly has become more of that. And then in terms of the teaching aspect of it, you know, again, I decided, as I mentioned to you, I decided to open it up more to other people. Primarily from the perspective of, you know, my godmother was a big factor in this. She's like, you have something to say that people need to hear. You have something to offer that people need. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. And I felt it. I felt it in my play with people in improv. Like, you know, I really do listen to people, not just in scenes, but like before and after scenes and messages I would get, you know, through social media from people that I just met and did a scene with and the things they would say. I mean, you reached out to me, you know what I mean? It's like, after, you know, people would hit me up being a detective as an actor that I am, I read between the lines of what people are saying. And people may not, you know, say things to you directly, but they do say things indirectly, particularly when they don't know you.
Yeah.
You know, so that I'm like, you know, I want to be of service in many ways, you know, and one of those ways is that way. And another thing to be honest with you, that's super important to me is as a black man, as a person of color, that for me was like, you know what? I know our voice needs to be out there and heard, because I've been at the UCBs and the Second Cities, and I love all those. I'm just saying those for a reason, just to put it out there, because there's a certain, and I mentioned the celebrity thing before, there's a certain narrative that can be pushed, you know, and I'm like, you know, we have stuff to say in this world, in this realm. And, you know, a lot of times, and I do advocate for people of color in this. And one of the best ways I can do it is to really work to be good at it myself and be supportive when I play and be inclusive when I play. And that will resonate and hit the people it needs to hit. And, you know, a lot of the people that have come to my classes and that continue to, I have two new people today, are people that respond to that. You know, they're, you know what I mean? And that's important. And that really is an emotional thing for me. Like I'm getting kind of choked up even saying it now. You know, it is very emotional, because it's like, we all have that power. We all have it, no matter what, who we are, what we are, what we look like, period.
Yeah. Wow. That's beautiful. I making me almost want to choke up.
We can choke up together, and it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. That was beautiful. I think this is, we could keep talking, but I think that's the most perfect way I think we could end this podcast. Tez, where can people find you? Plug any kind of workshops you have. Tell people where to find you.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you for that. The easiest, God bless social media for that reason too, right? It's easy to put stuff out there. So, I usually do, I mean, I always do Facebook event for my classes and Instagram. And you can message me on either of those, but Tez Yancey, TezYancey. If you put that into Facebook or Instagram, that's the same thing for my email, that name at Gmail. You can always message me directly at any of those to get information about classes. But it's all the information is there. I'm doing weekend classes right now. Have a musical improv class I've been trying to put together for the longest time, but it's a scheduling thing, but that will be coming. Because I know there's people that want to do that, as do I. But Facebook, Instagram, email, direct message me.
Yeah, and I, you would have to be an excellent person to take a musical improv class from, because you come from that world and the improv world.
Yeah.
I know we said we're going to end the podcast, but do you do any musical improv yourself? Have you been in many groups like that?
Yes, I do. There's some fun stuff. You know, I so fortunate, you know, certain people, like I got to do some stuff with some pretty awesome folks. And there's a couple different groups I kind of bop in and out of that are going around. There's a pack show once a month called Crushing It that this guy Velvet does. And I've been popping in and out of that. I used to do it live. That was the thing. That's one of the things I do miss most, is doing that live. And a buddy of mine out of Vegas, my best friend's a guitar player for my band. And he and I are talking about, like with this musical improv class, talking about doing something together, but also doing something performance wise with that. But I've been really fortunate to work with some incredible people, and even on the musical improv front, you know.
That's awesome. I just wanted to ask that. I couldn't just leave that on the table.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Tez, this has been really, really awesome. You're obviously such a thoughtful guy. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you, Andy. Same here.
Yeah, and just you know, have a good one.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you having me. Stay safe, my friend.
Thank you so much again to Tez for being on the show. He's just so awesome. I love talking to him. Definitely find him on social media. Email him if you need to. Take his classes. Get to know him. He's great. I also want to take this opportunity to plug my other podcast called Rotary. Rotary, surprise, surprise, is an improvised comedy podcast. It follows a series of characters through a series of phone calls, and it's all professionally produced, professionally recorded. And I add a lot of sound effects in post. It's just really fun, and it's my passion project. You can find Rotary on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, really wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Rotary Pod. All right. Have a good one.